Choke points.
Let's go.
Rules of the road edition. Chris is about to tackle one of the scariest maneuvers that most of us see on the roads. That's called lane sweeping.
And Dave, you know just how dangerous this is. And it's funny that I'm bringing this up now because I saw something yesterday on my way to work that just kind of reinforced that we need to talk about this. It's a move I'm sure we've all seen before and all too often. So here's the situation. I was entering southbound I-5 from the 164th on ramp in Linwood, put on my signal to get in the left lane and move over one lane, prepared to merge when the person behind me on that same on ramp veered across the gore point at about a 45 degree angle across all three lanes of traffic just to get into the fast lane, even though there was no traffic anywhere else along the way, just veered over. It's called lane sweeping. And why I find this ironic is just a few days ago, listener David Anderson sent me a note asking to remind everybody about this particular rule. And let's be crystal clear. What that driver did to me is 100% illegal for multiple reasons. First, you can't cut across a gore point. That's totally illegal. If you don't know what a gore point is, that's basically where the two white lines come to an end, where the freeway and the on-ramp meet. It kind of comes to a point, looks like the horn of a bull or something. That's why you would get gored if you hit it. So you can't cross that, and you cannot just veer across lanes. Under Washington law, you must turn into the lane closest to you. That not only goes for intersections, but on the road as well. You must establish yourself in a lane before you move again. So the guy behind me needed to wait, get over, if he was still insistent on going all the way to the left-hand lane. It's really simple. You driving in a lane, if you're driving in a lane, you can only move one lane at a time, to the left or to the right. That's it.
But Chris, what if I'm late for work?
It doesn't matter.
What if I'm really late for work?
No, it doesn't
matter.
What
if I'm really late for work and if I miss this exit, the next one's 10 miles away?
Then you should have planned better. Huh. And you should have maybe gotten behind the person, slowed down a little bit in order to make your exit.
What if I've watched every movie Fast and Furious and I know what I'm doing?
Well, first of all, I would question you know what you're doing by watching all the Fast and Furious movies, me having never seen one.
I think we're just teasing
at
this point. Yeah,
I know. And let me break it down for that. That's the freeway and the highway. When you're turning at an intersection, you must also turn into the closest lane possible. This is one that I see people mistake all the time. So if you're turning right, you must turn into the closest right lane. Don't sweep into that second lane, if there is one. If you're turning left, you must turn into the closest left lane. I know you need to get to the Starbucks across the intersection, which has a right turn into the parking lot, but you can't turn left into that second lane. It's super dangerous. It's illegal. It's incredibly selfish, and it's not something that you should do.
Now, on the left turn, this is what happens to me. So, because I know that rule. So I make a left turn into the leftmost lane, but I need to turn right. The person behind me screams over into the right lane, and as I'm trying to turn, there they are.
That's their fault. If you were to hit them, they would be at fault because they swept into the, and that happens to me all the time too. That's why I'm almost looking in my rearview mirror as I'm making that turn to know where that person's going, because they're invariably going to sweep to get around you. They always do. They being everybody, right? And I checked them when we've done this story before. Yeah, if they were to sweep over and if you were to merge and you were to hit their front quarter panel, they would be at fault because they made an illegal turn. And you had the right of way there. One thing that I am checking out, because Heather Bosch brought this up in the newsroom when asking, she's like, okay, Seattle has very unique sets of circumstances. What if, say, you're in an intersection and you're turning right, but the nearest right lane is a bus-only lane?
Mm-hmm.
So do you turn into that and then merge over?
No,
or do you
think so.
Sweep around that to go into that second lane? Are they forcing you to lane sweep? I'm waiting for official confirmation from the Department of Transportation's engineers and from the people who write the driver's licensing book. But I did get an idea from the State Patrol what they think, even though they wouldn't have jurisdiction on something like that, is that they would consider that a restricted lane. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you're not a bus, that isn't your closest lane. So you may have to then take the right and necessarily sweep past that bus only lane to get over. So again, there's certain circumstances, but that one, if it's a painted red bus lane, you should probably, but I'm waiting for official confirmation from two other sources on this to go along with what I heard from troopers.
Wow. Thank you, Chris.
Breaking history news.
It is not Wednesday. It is not Friday. It is Thursday. But our resident historian, Felix Spinell, is here doing overtime because of a breaking history news story from Sumner, where a group working to save the Ryan House scored a legal victory yesterday. And another story from Seattle, where a local history group on Facebook has had their page stolen by hackers. He's here on his rocket-powered Wayback Mobile. So bring
us up
today. It's
like being with Walter Cronkite this morning, Dave. I like when you talk about rocket launches.
It sounds good.
So last September, the Sumner City Council abruptly decided to demolish the historic Ryan House right there in downtown, totally switching gears on what had been a multi-year effort to raise money and restore the home. It was built in the 1860s, donated to the city 100 years ago. It housed the library in the past, figured prominently in the city's comprehensive plan as a link between the past, present, and future. A group of citizens didn't like that. They thought it was too abrupt. They've been trying to get the city to listen to them about preserving the house. One arm of their campaign was a lawsuit in Pierce County Superior Court, alleging the city didn't follow the law in terms of public process and giving proper notice and seeking public input. Yesterday, Judge Stanley Rumbaugh agreed with the citizens and sent the city of Sumner back to the old drawing board, forcing them to start over with the process if they do want to, in fact, continue to demolish. Nick Bierman is chairperson of the Friends of the Ryan House. That's a project of the Sumner Historical Society. What this verdict means is that what they've been saying all along to the city, that the process was flawed and the decision was hasty, it's been validated by the legal system.
We're relieved that the judge saw it the way that we have been saying it the whole time, and they didn't side with the city. The city was essentially saying that it's their property. They can do what they want with it.
Now, the next step is a big public meeting in Sumner on April 4th to discuss the city's comprehensive plan, the whole plan. But this is sure to come up then. And I reached out to the Sumner city spokesperson last night around 6:30, but haven't heard back yet. I reached out pretty late, of course. Now, the second story is very disturbing. There's a Facebook group called Seattle Vintage, which has been around for many years, has about 140,000 followers. It's a great place to see historic photos and stories. I often post links to my stories there. Pretty much every city in the country has a similar page, started by volunteers. It's not a money-making effort. There's one for Portland, Spokane, Vancouver. As bad as social media can be, there's something about these local history pages that I think makes up for those bad parts. It's a great little online community of sharing. Last week, hackers took over Seattle Vintage, kicked out the page administrators. I talked to a couple of very active users of the page. A guy named Doug Palmer figured out the hackers are overseas somewhere, maybe Ukraine, maybe Pakistan. They've done this before to other pages. Their end goal is a little murky. They probably won't extort anyone to sell the page back, but they'll probably sell the page and all those followers to someone who can do maybe one post about trying to sell some bogus service or product or something.
Now they're stealing our history.
They've stolen the history, right? Now, Doug Palmer, they've reached out to Facebook and have gotten absolutely no assistance. There's no mechanism to actually report what's happened. He's reached out to the FBI and the Washington Attorney General's office, not heard back yet. Meanwhile, the Seattle Vintage founders have launched Seattle Vintage 2.0. It's got less than 1,000 followers, but it's growing. I talked to David Rubel. He grew up in Seattle. He's one of the most prolific posters on the page. He's heartbroken, but he's defiant.
They can steal the site, but they're never going to get the community. They can't steal us. And I think that's the point. We can start over with a new site, and we have started over with a new site. They will never be able to rob us of the community that we have. Yeah.
So there's more to learn about the story, especially if the attorney general can help.
Yeah, okay. Stronger password this time, I hope.
Yeah. No kidding.
Let's talk about a term that's floating around groups on the left. It's the idea of basically fake liberals. The term has been coined illiberalism. I called up Richard Kahlenberg, who's a professorial lecturer of public policy and administration at George Washington University. He has been writing a lot about this concept and told me about a recent article.
I really focused on, on college campuses, where we've seen a lot of activism around the Middle East. And there, I think at root, illiberalism, which is kind of an opposition to liberal democratic norms like free speech, no political tests for hiring. I think it comes actually from a good place initially. So there was a desire to make sure that our campuses are open and racially diverse. But then it was taken in a very different direction where we ended up with a lot of intolerance of people who might not, for example, support racial preferences in deciding who gets into college, who think there should be political tests as to who gets hired. These kinds of things have creeped in. And in particular, we see a clamping down on free speech, where people who might have more conservative political views views I personally disagree with, will be shouted down on campus and not permitted to speak. So I think to be clear, I think the biggest illiberalism is on the kind of authoritarian right. But at the same time, there's illiberalism on the left as well that should be addressed.
I've noticed that the phrase, that's not okay, is being used by a lot of people to shut down debates, saying these are subjects we are not even going to bring up because that's just not okay.
Yeah, it's a troubling concept, especially on a university campus where we're supposed to be exploring ideas. I was in a debate about 4 or 5 years ago at Middlebury College in Vermont about affirmative action. And my position is I support affirmative action based on economic status. And my colleague was supporting it based on race. And there were students who did not want to see the debate happen. They said it was offensive to have a mere discussion about what the best path to diversity is. So, there are things that are out of bounds. And I think the problem is students then graduate to the real world and find out, well, wait, some of these ideas are contested and should be subject to scrutiny and debate back and forth.
We're hearing from Richard Kahlenberg, an author and professional lecturer at professorial lecturer on public policy, who's been looking into the concept of illiberalism, as he did on this study of college campuses. Which led me to the question, could this be basically a generational difference? Because it seems that a lot of younger people don't want their views to be tested or debated.
I think it is generational. And if you look at the polls, the percentage of Americans who say it's really important to follow, classical liberal democratic norms around free speech and the like. It's among young people, the numbers are much lower. There are a lot of them who say no, democracy is not the best form of government, and that we don't need these protections for speech. So the big question, which I don't know the answer to, is whether young people will grow up and figure out that, in fact, it's a blessing to live in a society where you have the right to say what's on your mind, or whether this portends some longer term shift, which would be very, very damaging, I think, for the country.
So in terms of the upcoming election, what are you looking for in a presidential candidate? What do you see any way that either candidate could bring the country together?
Well, I'll just, I don't mean to be partisan, but I do think that Joe Biden offers possibilities to bring our country together. I think it will require some distancing from those far left ideas. And he's done it well with respect to defund the police. At the State of the Union a couple of years ago, he said, no, fund them. So he made clear that he drew a line, distancing himself from far left ideas on crime. I think that by pointing out that he disagrees with those on the left who are embracing illiberal ideas, I think that would do a lot toward reassuring people who are in the center, maybe the center right, that in fact, he wants to be someone who represents everyone.
What this is all leading to is the big question, and that is there room? I mean, we have a big presidential election, but we also have congressional elections, right? Is there room for candidates who think the way you do, who look at these issues and don't fit neatly into a box? Because it seems to me that today's politicians have to do what we're taught to do in acting school. That is, always make a strong character choice, right? If you're going to play a character, make strong choices that are obvious to the audience. And that sounds like what's going on now. So the people like you are pretty much kept out of the campaign.
Yeah, it is interesting. There are some of us who feel like we don't quite fit neatly into the traditional political boxes. who are looking, you know, who look at issues and say, well, on the one hand, this is a strong argument. On the other hand, you know, the conservatives have a point to make. And how can we find a good synthesis that will advance us as a country? I think, you know, if you look at the political affiliation numbers, we see fewer Democrats, fewer Republicans, more independents. And so there is an appetite for, you know, reasonable candidates who acknowledge that issues are complex and nuanced, and that there's something to be said for many sides of different arguments and trying to come up with the best thing for the country. So I think there is room for that. The structures of our, you know, primary system in congressional districts and the gerrymandering that goes on means that oftentimes these districts are either very red or very blue. And unfortunately, that does not lend itself to kind of the reasonable thinking that the vast majority of Americans, I think, share.
Yeah. Well, there is a place for liberals who want to be thoughtful about this kind of thing, and even for visiting conservatives. And I want to thank Richard Kahlenberg for joining us today. He teaches at George Washington University. He writes for the Liberal Patriot, and he has a book called Excluded: How Snob Zoning, NIMBYism, and Class Bias Build the Walls We Don't See. Great title. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dave. Appreciate it.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. CBS News followed the story of a remarkable recovery at the Shepherd Center in Atlanta, where one man's journey after a severe brain and spinal injury shows what it means to overcome the impossible. Here's CBS's Mark Strassman.
In a world of noisy naysayers, Woody Morgan represents possibility.
I set the bar super high here for what kind of care patients receive.
We can definitely do that.
This is Atlanta's Shepherd Center, a premier facility for patients with brain and spinal cord trauma. In this space, Morgan's often mistaken for a patient.
What? You're my doctor? Are you really in the chair? Or I've had people say, is that chair for me? You know, I'm like, no, this one's mine.
A swimming accident in 2008 left Morgan a broken man. He was 20, a pre-med collegiate soccer player.
Dove into a wave and probably hit a sandbar, or the wave crashed just the wrong way and hit my head down.
Do you remember feeling anything?
No, I was out, so I lost consciousness. Next thing I know, I was in a hospital room.
Two broken vertebrae in his neck, a catastrophic injury leaving him paralyzed from the chest down. Morgan spent months as a patient at Shepherd, reconciling himself to the unthinkable. This athlete would never walk again.
Early on, it was rough.
And was it hard for you to wrap your head around that?
I would say it's certainly a good year or two before, you know, feel solidly comfortable living life in a chair and with an injury like this.
Were you told you might want to rethink that med school dream?
Yeah, in so many words, yeah. Like, all right, well, I'm going to get through this. I'm going to show you how to do it.
In 2015, he graduated in a wheelchair from Tulane Medical School. His specialty, rehabbing patients grappling with a sort of catastrophic injury he had.
But we use this to put the pads on specific muscles.
In 2023, then 35 years old, he returned to Shepherd.
Over the years, I must have seen hundreds of patients. He's the only one that we have gotten to come back as a doctor.
Dr. John Lynn, Shepherd's director of spinal cord medicine, remembers treating Morgan 16 years ago.
Did you feel in your gut that he would actually go to medical school?
I didn't think so. Mostly because I have heard so many people said they were going to do it and they never make it there. I never thought he was going to actually do it because this is not an easy injury to overcome.
But Morgan remembers seeing Lynn, his doctor, also paralyzed in a wheelchair because of his own medical condition.
First time you saw him, surprised?
Certainly was more like an aha moment.
Motivating?
Yes, certainly motivating.
So when we both started from scratch, and that's a difficult journey.
Not only difficult, improbable. Woody Morgan, wheelchair and all right. Proof that no dream is broken beyond repair.
That is CBS's Mark Strassman.
And here he is from the Gene Ursula Show, G. Scott. Are you a TikTok user? Do you have an account?
No. Yes, I have an account, but It's not my favorite place to go.
So
I don't know.
Why not? Are you concerned about the security threat? Where do you come down on the TikTok issue?
No, I don't really. My co-host Ursula is she's concerned about the ban. She doesn't want TikTok banned. She loves TikTok. Mm. I feel like an old man on there. I'm just like, I don't really understand this thing, right? I don't understand all the algorithms that it goes on. It's kind of hard to post, so I don't really kind of understand it. But it's going on right now, and I know that there's a lot of people that don't want TikTok banned. I say name it AR-15, because if they name it AR-15, it's not going anywhere, right? But I look at it like this. Why is this really happening, right? Like, I remember when Donald Trump was in office, he wanted to get rid of TikTok. And we all know the connection to China and everything like that. He wanted to get rid of it. And now Donald Trump wants to keep TikTok. And I think it's probably because he's mad at Mark Zuckerberg and being banned on Facebook after January 6th. So he's now wanting to keep TikTok. I will say this. I do think that there is, in my heart, I think that there's some type of a whole lot of benefit to Mark Zuckerberg if TikTok does go away, right? Like, if TikTok goes away and it is banned, even though the youngsters will use their VPNs and still try to get a hold of it anyways, but it'll still be tougher nevertheless. I do think that there is some type of motivation for TikTok to be banned. And I do think that there is some pressure and persuasion and somehow some money that really leans towards the decision to do this.
Zuckerberg could buy it, and that would satisfy the legislation. It could stay on. He'd just buy it.
Microsoft has expressed interest, I guess. Yeah, I mean, you could have a U.S. company buy it.
Mm-hmm. Well, ByteDance doesn't want to sell it. I guess the thing with China is they have this policy of either owning companies, you know, any company that's a private company has partial government ownership, or the government very closely monitors what the CEOs do. And there have been a number, it's sort of like Russia, right? You can be rich, but you can't be rich and oppose the government in any way, or suddenly, you know, your parking spot is empty. So I think that's the source of Congress's concern, that whether, you know, China expressly owns a part of it or not, if the government wants access to the data, it can get access.
I guess a question that I think that we can all ask and probably wonder, and maybe you've thought it yourself, would be this. How did it get this far? Right? Like, how did
it get popular?
How did TikTok, right? So we know that it's...
People love it, that's why.
No.
It's not right. You know,
no.
We don't have many regulations when it comes to internet companies, to social media companies. I mean, we barely have regulation of those U.S. companies,
right?
Let alone the Chinese companies. So I think that's how we got here.
Right, but you would think... I think the reason why we don't is because you have a lot of people that are in Congress that are... I'm not trying to make an age thing here.
They didn't see it coming. They're not users of the apps. Yeah,
you know what I mean? I mean, so years ago, you should have saw this coming. It's owned by China. You know that China is going to, their government is going to oversee any information that's being gathered with this company. You would think that then you thought it was a threat. So now, today, you're like, hey, this isn't good. Really, Charlie?
Well, we had U.S. companies, too, selling our information during the election, right? Yeah. And they did nothing about that. No. So they're not, the fact that they're not, you know, that now they're going after China, but they can barely go after U.S. companies selling our data. That, to me, is laughable.
Yeah.
But any protection is necessary. I mean, I've cut the cord on a lot of these social media sites, and I realize just how influential and addictive they are.
They are.
You start to believe the reels and the memes that you see, and you're like, oh yeah, I relate to that. Maybe I have ADHD. And you're like, hold on, this person's not a doctor.
Well, I got the magic. I got the magic sauce for y'all.
Yeah. What?
Here's the idea. This is going to do to alleviate the problem that we have, especially surrounding social media and TikTok. We should have two almost or are 80-year-olds run for president. All right. Gotta go.
Good idea.
By the way, shout out to Charlie Harger, because I did use Charlie.
You should be on TikTok. Those pearls would go viral instantly.
I did put you guys on TikTok once, and then I stopped because it was like, boo.
And that's Mickey time. She's been reading census data. Wow, that sounds fascinating.
It's fun times, actually.
Mr. C-SPAN.
It's fun times.
And it shows a drastic spike in couples in Seattle who are living together out of wedlock. This is terrifying.
Why didn't we have that sound?
Yeah. Mostly because the cost of living here is expensive.
Uh-huh.
So moving in together means couples can share the cost. And some are actually saving for a home.
I'll say that they don't really care about each other. They're just looking for somebody who can also afford to help pay the rent.
No, they care for each other. These are couples that really love each other. They're not roommates. They're not roommates. These are real couples. Also, that was something I found interesting is religion might play another factor. Because Census Bureau says Seattle is one of the least religious big cities in the country.
Right. But I mean, if you're trying to save money and living together for that reason, get married and get the marriage deduction.
Why, though, if you're not ready?
I mean, that's a really good point because I think married couples, we have over, 1,200 tax breaks that we can qualify for.
Yeah. But then you're legally bound to another person for $1,500 off your taxes. No, thank you.
You're living with somebody you don't want to live with?
No, you're living with somebody who you could potentially marry. But for now, you just need a place to live and to save money, you live together.
And for the most part, what the Census Bureau found is that these couples do love each other and they may plan on getting married someday. They're just not doing or ready right now.
This is incredibly common. This is what my husband and I did when we were dating back in 2006, 2007, 2008. We didn't get married till 2011. David, our producer, you were living with your wife before you got married. I mean, it's just not a big deal these days.
Well, you said something. I'm so sorry. I apologize. You said something that's very interesting, that this is very common. Well, yeah, it's even more common now because the data says that there are 42,000 dating couples in Seattle living together. That is up about, I think, 83%. It's an 83% jump from 2010 when there were only 23,000. And David, you lived with your wife before you guys got married.
Absolutely. And it was never even a question. And I know that part of it is this financial pressure that you feel. And it, you know, it makes it easier when you can be roommates with someone who you are also romantically
and you're not
involved
just sharing
with.
Rent or more. You're sharing grocery costs. You're sharing electricity. It's so much more than.
But you're in separate bedrooms, right?
No. Why would you be in separate bedrooms? Come on, Dave.
But here's the thing,
and this sort of ruffles some feathers, certainly with my parents, who I was raised evangelical Christian, and they were, for each of my siblings who have all lived with their partners, even before financial stability was an issue for siblings, you know, going back decades now, because I have so many siblings, who all lived with their partners before getting married. Part of it for us, I know, is getting to know this person that you're going to be cohabitating with. Are they, do you wake up at the same time as them? Are your sleep patterns similar? Are they sloppy?
Do they leave their dirty socks on the floor?
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Like
and
that.
You don't want to get into a marriage with someone who you've never lived with because then what happens if a month into the marriage, you find out, oh gosh, they
talk in their sleep,
exactly.
And I can't
work it out. Then you work it out.
You do work it out.
It's easier to work it out when you're not. You don't have the pressure of the marriage.
I don't know. These are things you find out usually about year 4 or 5 of the marriage.
Well, not anymore.
Well, what was really interesting is that when I met my wife's parents and family for the first time, I ended up staying with her aunt. We stayed with her aunt, and I remember showing. Up, I had my bags, and her aunt's very, very religious. And she sat us down and she said, "Girls, I'm really sorry, but you can't sleep together in the guest room." And my wife said, "Well, why? I want to be very clear. Like, is it because we're gay?" And she goes, "No, it's because you're not married."
Oh my gosh.
And so she was like, "Andrea, you can sleep on the couch. Mickey, you can have the guest room." And I said, "You know what? We're going to take the Hyatt. Thank you."
Yeah, we'll be getting out of there.
Very similar conversations with my parents.
Right. So what was really interesting, according to the census data, is that Portland has more unmarried couples living together than we do. So they're up like 13%. We're at 11%.
Well, good for us.
Well, I guess things are changing.
Oh, Dave.
You don't have to play the part.
They've been changing.
I don't know. I'm reading my 1 Corinthians right now in Romans 8.
Yes.
And what does it say? Right now, I can't say some of these words. Actually, I can. Yeah. Fleeing from sexual immorality.
Mm-hmm. Oh, come on. Like,
I'm kidding. No, I lived in sin for 5 years. Come on.
We're 17 years strong now. I don't think living together before we got married.
21.
I have a great shacking up story strong. That I should share one day. It's awesome.
I love that. Please do.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.